Hello all, welcome to the talk on famous unsolved... That's it? Okay. You get really close to the microphone. Nope? Okay. So I'll be talking on famous unsolved codes. Can you guys hear me in the back? Still can't hear me. I'll get really close to the microphone. Now you can hear me. Okay. All right. If I start drifting back, just wave or something, and that'll, yeah, okay. So my name's Ilanka Dunin. I am a game developer, and I've been coming to Dragon Con for about 15 years now, giving talks on all kinds of different topics, from games to cryptography to Wikipedia and the Knights Templar, and I kind of have a short attention span, so I'm always going around and learning about different topics. But one of my main loves is really cryptography. And there's a long story of how I got into cryptography, and it really kind of centered around Dragon Con, so I'll just kind of bring that up briefly, which is, as I said, my day job was that I was a game developer. And I came to Dragon Con just to talk about games. And here, speaking in the Electronics Frontier Forum track, I would meet other speakers here in the track, some of those being hackers, that would come in to be talking about computer security. And so we'd kind of meet each other, you know, have a beer at the end of the day. And through them, I heard about this code that had been released at a hacker convention in Nashville called Freaknik, Phreaknik. And the code had been released as a challenge to the attendees of the conference, but it had been a year and no one had cracked the code yet. This was back in 1999. And so they were handing out the flyer and offering a prize. And I picked up the flyer along with all the flyers and stuff you get at Dragon Con, and I took it home to St. Louis with me. And I got really bored one weekend, and I started playing with the code, and I cracked it. And then I went around cracking a bunch of other codes. I won prizes like a free trip to a HackerCon, free hotel and drinks and t-shirts and all that stuff. And I've actually cracked so many codes in the hacker scene, I've actually been banned from competition. at the AtlantaCon hacker convention, when they released their code, it was on a sheet of paper. And at the bottom of the sheet, it said, "Note, past puzzle solvers are ineligible for prizes associated with solving the AtlantaCon puzzle. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka." So, so I cracked that one too. And then, you know, September 11th happened, and I was wondering if I could maybe use some of my cryptography experience to help out with the war on terrorism. So things kept growing. I called the local FBI in St. Louis, and I said, "Hey, you know, can I help?" And they said no. And then I kept calling them back, and finally I got an agent and said, "Well, what is it you know about?" And I said, "Oh, well, cryptography and this and that." And one of the types of cryptography I mentioned was something called steganography. And the agent said, "Hey, you know, we've been hearing rumors that Al-Qaeda was using steganography as a way of planning the September 11th attacks." And he said, "There's probably big brains in Washington, D.C. that know all about steganography, but we're here in St. Louis, and cryptography really isn't our mission. Maybe you could come in and give a talk about what steganography is." And I said, "Sure." And I think they thought I was going to give like a little 10, 15-minute presentation, but I ended up doing a full 70-slide PowerPoint presentation about steganography. I don't think Al-Qaeda was using steganography, but I found out what kind of codes they were using, and then I traced down the rumors of why there were rumors about Al-Qaeda using steganography, which boiled down. Steganography is a way of hiding messages inside of pictures on the Internet. And the rumors came because after September 11th, the Italian police had captured an Al-Qaeda cell in Milan, Italy, at the Via Quaranta Mosque. And when they captured the agent, the Al-Qaeda members, they also captured a bunch of laptop computers. And on these computers, there were many photographs of women who were not wearing clothing. And the Italian tabloids got a hold of this and said, "Oh my gosh, you know, Al-Qaeda, strict Muslim, why would they be looking at pictures of women? They must have been hiding messages inside of these images." And so, and that was a great story for the tabloids. But no, there weren't messages in those pictures, because sometimes porn is just porn. along with my talks, after I gave my talk at the local FBI, and there were other Secret Service and postal inspectors and customs agents, and I found myself getting invited all over the country to give talks about cryptography. And this sort of tied in with another interest that I had, which was when I'd solved the Freaknik code, it was designed sort of like an onion. There were many different layers of codes and puzzles in it, and there were dead ends. And one of those dead ends pointed to the CIA website and said, okay, now go solve this. And it was pointing to a sculpture, which you can see in this top slide, the one at the top left. This is a sculpture called Kryptos, K-R-Y-P-T-O-S. And it was a created by an artist named Jim Sanborn as a challenge to the employees at the CIA. And three of the it was installed in 1990, and there's four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. So coming back to my other part of my life, I kind of heard about Kryptos, and I was like, okay, haha, famous unsolved code. It's a dead end in the Freaknik code, and I went on with the rest of the code. And then I, after September 11th, I have a cousin who works in Washington, D.C., who actually had a very close call that morning. He was supposed to be working in the Pentagon, give a briefing, but he was running late because he was having printer problems. And he got the printer problems resolved, and he was on his way to the Pentagon, and he was checking his cell phone. His cell phone actually crashed because of all the messages from people saying, a plane just hit the Pentagon, don't go. And the plane hit right where he was supposed to be, so some of the people he was supposed to brief were killed on that really horrible day. So after September 11th, I flew out to Washington, D.C. to see my cousin, and we went to the memorial at the Pentagon and put a small American flag there, and then we were driving around. It was my first time in Washington, D.C., and my cousin said, well, as long as you're here, is there anything else you'd like to see in D.C.? There's lots of tourist attractions. And I said, well, no, you're the main reason I'm here. And he says, well, that's nice, but I like seeing you too, but is there anything else you want to see? And I thought, what about this sculpture, Kryptos, that I hear about? And he said, okay, we'll go take a look. So and he said, where's Kryptos? I said, well, it's in the central courtyard of the CIA. And he said, okay, that's Langley, Virginia, and we'll figure out where CIA is. And we had a little bit of trouble because there's no street address for CIA, and this was pre-Google Earth. But what I did was I sort of knew what the building was supposed to look like because I'd seen like Tom Clancy movies where they have like overhead view, CIA, and I got the satellite reconnaissance pictures of Langley, Virginia, and I went looking for the outline of that building, and so I knew where the CIA was. And so my cousin and I went and we drove by, and we figured that we'd kind of take the exit and kind of like drive around the service road or something. But when you take the exit, there's no service road. You take the exit and there's a gate, and it's a big gate, and there's barbed wire, and there's a guard shack, and big guys with guns come pouring out asking very reasonable question right after September 11th, who are you and why are you here? So I was saying, oh, we're here to see Kryptos. And so the guards kind of relaxed a little bit. And they said, sorry, you can't get in. It's official business only. And so my cousin and I were trying to think, could we talk our way into CIA? saying, okay, well, you know, is there like a public tour day? And they said, no, it's official business only. Can I get an invitation from a congressperson? No, official business only. And we kind of ran out of ideas. And like I said, these were big guys with guns. You know, so eventually my cousin and I turned away. But I was thinking about this from official business. So now we switch back over to this other track where I was doing this steganography talk for the local FBI. And I was saying, maybe I can use this as the official business that's going to get me into CIA. So when I needed to do before and after pictures of my talk of what steganography is, and show a picture without anything hidden in it, and then show a picture with something hidden in it, I need to pick a picture. It could be a flower or a tree or something, but I decided to use an image of Kryptos. So I would have a slide in my presentation, and I would say, this is an image without anything hidden, and this is with some. And you really can't see any difference between the images. But I would say, oh, by the way, that's Kryptos at CIA. I would love to give this talk at CIA someday. And so every time I gave the talk at universities and hacker conventions, I would show that slide, and I'd love to give that talk at CIA someday. So I'm at DEF CON, the big hacker convention in Las Vegas. Big rooftop tent. Ilanka speaks on steganography. And about 1,000 people in the tent. And I get to that point, and I'm showing the slide and go on with the rest of the talk. Well, at the end of the talk, people come up to you. They give you business cards and other things. And someone comes up to the podium, and they lean across, and they looked at me, and they said, I work at Langley. I think I can get you in. So they gave me a first name and a phone number. And Yeah. After the con, I'm thinking, okay, was this really a CIA agent or someone just a hacker pulling my chain and pretending to be at CIA? So I called the number and they said, okay, you know, send us your slides and we'll work on a speaking. And I said, wait, you got to prove you work at CIA. And they said, well, what do you want us to do? And I said, well, send me an email from an official CIA address. And they said, well, I don't have an email from an official CIA address. I said, we'll get an email from an official CIA address. About a week goes by, I get an email from at UCIA.gov, unclassified CIA.gov. And then I wrote back to it to make sure it wasn't just a spoofed email address, and so we had two-way communication. And long story short, I got an invitation to speak at CIA, and I got to see cryptos. I did some rubbings of the sculpture. There was an official photographer there that took a couple pictures. And at that point, I hadn't really worked on crypto, so it had just been a challenge for me to find it and to get a chance to see it. So now I saw cryptos, I had my rubbings, I went back to St. Louis, I posted them online, sort of a blog, you know, Ilanka's visit to CIA. And but then I started getting emails from all over the world. And people were asking me about cryptos and asking, well, who created cryptos? Well, Jim Sanborn. What else has he made? I don't know, call his agent. And helpful person that I am, I decided to try and make post a list of everything Sanborn had ever done. So I contacted his agent. I said, hey, can you send me a list of everything Sanborn's ever done? And they said, no, there's no such list. It would be too complicated. He's made too many things. It's impossible to make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. So, boom, the glove has been thrown. Okay, I'll make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. So I started writing to art galleries and any place Sanborn had done a show. And bit by bit, I'm gathering more and more knowledge about cryptos, about Sanborn, to the point where at one point he called me and he was like, who are you and why do you have a website about me? and I said, oh, Sanborn, I love your work. And so now we're on much better terms. We've gone out drinking. I've tried pumping him for information about that fourth section of the code. And I also got a call from an author named Dan Brown, who wrote a book called The Da Vinci Code. So any of you who have this edition of the book, Da Vinci Code, the American hardcover edition, you may know that there's puzzles hidden in the artwork of the book jacket. There's actually five puzzles, and I'll show you some slides of these. Two of those puzzles refer to cryptos. And this was something that Dan Brown was doing to give clues about the subject of his next novel, which was the sequel to Da Vinci Code called The Lost Symbol. And cryptos is a theme in The Lost Symbol. And so I was helping Dan Brown with the research about cryptos and some other elements of the book. And he thanked me by naming a character after me in The Lost Symbol. So if you've read The Lost Symbol, there's a character named Nola Kay, which is an anagram for Ilanka. So I just kind of fell into this. And as I was giving talks on cryptos and talks about Al-Qaeda codes, and other people were saying, oh, well, cryptos is a famous unsolved code. What are other famous unsolved codes? And I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to make a list of the world's most famous unsolved codes. And so I made this list and tried to come up with sort of a rating, very, very unscientific rating system of the fame of different unsolved codes. So that's kind of a long-winded way of me getting into that, of how I got involved with these codes. And I'm going to be touching on some of these codes. Mostly in this talk, I'm going to be going over cryptos. I'm going to be going over the Voynich manuscript, which is number two on the list. I'll be a little bit on the Beale ciphers, the Dorabella cipher, number three. Is there any code on this list that anybody just really wants to hear about? Yeah. The Zodiac Killer. Okay. All right. I'll touch on the Zodiac Killer. Yeah. The what?
The Phaistos Disc.
Phaistos Disc. Okay. All right. I have a couple slides on that. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's get into it here. So the Voynich manuscript, and I have a replica. If anyone wants to come up later, of the Voynich manuscript, and it's hundreds of pages of this bizarre script, and there's images and there's circles and there's plants, and I'll show you slides, which is going to be much easier to see here. And we don't know what it says, and it's not in any recognized language, it's not in any recognized alphabet. We've never found anything else that uses that alphabet or uses that kind of a script. So it's this really incredible mystery. We've radiocarbon dated the pages of it, and each page is made of a very elaborate vellum, a parchment. It's basically from the stomach of a sheep. And we know that those sheep, the sheep from whom the vellum was made, lived between about 1408 and 1438, which may or may not help date the manuscript. Is anyone here an Ingress player, played the Google game Ingress? Okay, there's a couple back there. You've heard about Voynich. Voynich has been tied into many, many different works of fiction. It's also being currently worked into this game called Ingress, a location-based game. And when I met the guys at Niantic, they were very interested that I had a replica of the Voynich manuscript. We're taking pictures of it, so those make it, my manuscript may get worked into some of the future game materials. We'll have to see. There's hundreds of images of plants in there, and we can't identify the plants. They're generally, like, we'll see a plant, we'll say, oh, we sort of recognize that flower, but that flower would never have those leaves. Or we sort of recognize those roots, but those roots would never be associated with that kind of a flower. So it's sort of random, but whoever did it put a lot of work into it. We think it was done by one person. There's some debate. It might have been done by two or three people. We've analyzed the handwriting. We've analyzed the ink that's used in there. Big mystery. And then there's all these sections of, away from the plants, of these kind of plumbing-like contraptions with these little naked women in them. So maybe herbal baths of some sort, or we just don't know. I can't tell you for sure. It's just one of the world's grand mysteries. This is a flower, a passion. It looks like a passion flower. But anyone who knows a passion flower knows the passion flowers have 10 petals. This one has 5. Why would that be different? Again, we don't know. If we were to transcribe the text into something Latin, that's sort of what it would look like. It seems to have a rhythm. There are repeating patterns. There are word breaks in it. Things that there aren't, there's no punctuation anywhere in the entire document. We can tell it was written left to right. There's no crossouts. Nothing was written, no one went back and said, cross something out or scraped it off or anything and went back. Everything was written one time. So, big mystery. It's possible, so what is the Voynich manuscript? What are the leading theories? One theory is that this is another document. We do know what it is, De Materia Medica, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, from the 15th century, where they would make sort of a catalog of herbs, and so they would be drawing pictures of the herbs next to text, and you might find these in Latin, you might find these in Arabic. So someone may have been trying to just copy something and just copied it poorly. Another possibility is it might have been a snake oil salesman. You got to think around 1400s. This is about 100 years after the Great Plague going through Europe, so people were a little more health conscious. And so people were interested in ointments and remedies. And the price of a remedy would be directly related to the rarity of the herbs that were in that remedy. So if a snake oil salesman were wanting to charge a high price for something, he might have used the Voynich manuscript as some sort of a catalog, saying, look at these herbs, you've never seen herbs like this, they came from far, far away, that's why I need to charge so much for this cream, will that be cash or charge? So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that also in this period of time, the Philosopher's Stone, people were very interested in alchemy and searching for different ways to make different materials. So someone may have been experimenting. Maybe these plants, they were mixing and matching different plants, sort of like people were mixing and matching different elements. They were trying to invent something or see what happened. Perhaps there's something, perhaps it's in code. And the key to this code was kept in a family and has just been lost, so we no longer know how to solve that particular code. And perhaps it was a hoax. Emperor Rudolf II around then was known for collecting curiosities. He would pay gold ducats, hundreds of gold ducats. And so it's possible that someone created the Voynich manuscript as a curiosity specifically for him to purchase. And we're pretty sure, we have some documentation saying that it was purchased by Emperor Rudolf for about 400 gold ducats, which would be about $100,000 in today's money. So for $100,000, people might create a very elaborate, very carefully drawn, carefully written hoax. We've also found that on the first page of the manuscript, you can't see it anymore, but if you use black light, you can see a signature of one of the owners, which is Tepinets. And Tepinets was the royal botanist of Emperor Rudolf II. So again, it's another clue that this was probably really purchased by Rudolf. this is an image from another real herbal, and just showing that it would have that same pattern of plants kind of interwoven with the writing on the page. And then back to Voynich manuscript and showing pictures of a real passion flower and then the passion flower that was in the Voynich manuscript. So why someone would change the number of petals like that? Or did they really have something different? We don't know. We just don't know. There's also these images on the left. These are from the Voynich manuscript. And there's several pages like this that have these kind of tubes. So one theory is that these tubes, and this is an image of an early microscope. Sometimes they would do this with lenses, or they would do this with water, different containers of water to try and magnify. So it's possible that someone in the 1400s was playing with magnification, and the fantastic images that they were drawing were what they were seeing under the microscope. Possible. Again, just lots of different theories. This is one of the most famous pages in the manuscript. It's a fold-out page. It's called the rosette page. And again, so much work that's been put into it. And one possible clue to where the Voynich manuscript was made, it's called the Voynich manuscript because it was named after, in the early 1900s, a bookseller named Wilfred Voynich, who purchased it. And he spent the rest of his life trying to understand it and was never able to. And we're not even sure where it was made. But a clue is, in this rosettes page, there's like a circle of images. And one of these circles is a sideways image of a castle. And what's interesting about this castle is these, on the battlements, you can see that they're not like just a square wave, but they've got these little dips in them. And it's an architectural element called a swallowtail merlon. And at the time that these days you can find this architectural element pretty much everywhere in the world. But at the time we think this was made, these kinds of swallowtail merlons only really existed in northern Italy. So it may be a clue as to where the manuscript was created. This is one theory that was published in Scientific American a few years ago about someone who was trying to prove the hoax theory, and he thinks that Voynich manuscript may have been created with what's called a card and grill, which is you take a card and you cut holes in it and you make this big grid, and then you just move the card across the page, and then whatever the syllables are, then you write out those syllables. So it would be a way of writing something in a very systematic form. And it's a good theory. I personally don't buy into it because I've corresponded with the very bright academic who came up with this. It's a plausible theory, but he's never been able to replicate a single page of the Voynich manuscript using this type of a method. So again, it's just sort of a guess. So kind of summing up the Voynich theories, every possible thing has a counterargument. Was it a hoax? Could have been a hoax, but it took a long time to make it. It's a really elaborate hoax if it was one. Could it have been some sort of artificial language? Maybe. But when we've looked at other languages that are artificial languages, the patterns and the grammar don't really quite match with it. Perhaps it was just made by someone who was mentally ill, some wealthy child of a family, and they just gave him or her lots of parchment and images, parchment and pens and ink and dyes, and saying, here, do whatever you want. So they spent their time making this elaborate Voynich manuscript. But if they were writing, if they were schizophrenic and they were just writing randomly, there's still a lot of repeating patterns. So it still looks like a language in Voynich manuscript. And it could be encrypted, but if it's encrypted, why is it encrypted? So just question after question. And other theories, I won't go into all of these in detail, but there's many books written on the Voynich manuscript. All right, and it's called The World's Most Mysterious Manuscript. So going over some of the other famous unsolved codes, one of them is Edgar Allan Poe. He was known for cracking codes. It was a hobby of his. He would ask people to send in ciphers, and he would claim that he could solve any cipher as long as it was a single alphabet cipher. Well, anyone who has experience with codes knows that if you're dealing with just a single alphabet cipher, it can be solved in seconds. It's called a monoalphabetic substitution cipher. It's one of the easiest kinds of ciphers to solve. But Poe got quite a following because he could crack all these codes. But when he ended his column, he presented two challenge ciphers. And those remained unsolved for about 100 years until they were being posted on the internet and got some more attention, and then they were finally solved. The first one was solved in 1992, and then the second in 2000. So this one which used these symbols from typewriters, was the soul secure in her existence smiles at the drawn dagger and defies its point, which was from some text, some literature at the time. And then the other one was this one was a more complex cipher. Instead of a monoalphabetic cipher, it's called a polyalphabetic cipher. It used different alphabets. And it was early spring, warm and sultry glowed the afternoon. And I think that was a quote from a play that was popular at the time. Right. Now we have the Phaistos disk. Now we're jumping around a thousand years here. This is a disk that was discovered near Greece. And we're seeing both sides of it here, and it has these symbols that are stamped on it in a very regular pattern. But it looks like groupings, it looks like words perhaps, but again, we have no idea what it says. It was discovered in the early 1900s. We think it dates back to about 1800 BC. And it's also possible that it might end up being some sort of a Rosetta Stone. There's other languages that we've never been able to read. Linear A, Linear B. Linear B has been solved. Linear A, we still have many, many examples of this language we can't read. This disk was found near a place where Linear A was used, so it's possible if we can figure out how this is put together, it might be a clue towards solving Linear A, but we don't know. Dorabella, this was written by Edward Elgar. So if you've ever been in the a graduation ceremony, that pomp and circumstance, that's what Edward Elgar. He loved codes. And he wrote some pieces called the Enigma Variations, where each variation of music was related to a friend of his, and you had to figure out which one related to whom. And he enjoyed playing with pencil and paper ciphers as well. And he wrote a message to a young woman. She was the daughter of a friend of his, and her name was Miss Dora Penny. She was not a cryptographer. She was not, this wasn't something that she would normally solve recreationally. And so there's this message that Elgar wrote. And since he sent it to Dora Penny, you would think that it couldn't have been that difficult because he knew that she wasn't a cryptographer. But here it is many generations later, and we still have no idea what it says. It sort of looks like a substitution cipher. People have played with it and tried different techniques, maybe associated with music or notes going up or notes going down, but we still don't know. Famous unsolved code. Zodiac ciphers. So the Zodiac killer, a serial killer who from 1966 to 1974, he had several victims. He would taunt the public and he would taunt the police. He would send these messages to newspapers saying, these give clues as to who I am. One of them was cracked, and it's a fairly unpleasant message about how he likes killing people and how much fun it was. It didn't give any specific information about how to find him, so that part wasn't true. Many spelling errors in it, and spelling errors always make a code much, much more difficult to crack. But we have several other messages of his, and we still have no idea what they say. Anyone who's interested in this, you can definitely go and Google Zodiac Killer, and you can see these messages and try your hand at them if you want. Beale ciphers. This is a pamphlet that was written in the late 1800s in Virginia that talked about a code, that talked about a treasure that was buried, and that there were three encrypted messages that had information. That one message said what was buried, another said where it was buried, and another said who it belonged to. And there's a long, long story here, but in a nutshell, it was that someone had gone to the Western United States and had mined with some friends a great deal of gold and gems, and then they transported it by wagon back through St. Louis to Virginia, where this gentleman buried it, and then he left three encrypted messages with the innkeeper saying, in a lockbox, saying, if I don't return, go ahead and open the box. And the man never returned. The box was open. The messages were found. One of the messages was cracked. The other messages not cracked, and then were passed off to someone else who tried and couldn't solve those two messages and finally said, okay, I'm washing my hands of it here. I'm publishing everything I know about it in this pamphlet. And so everything modern day we know about the Beale ciphers is from this one pamphlet. We haven't been able to corroborate any of the rest of it. So it's possible that it's an urban legend. It's possible, again, that it was a hoax. Perhaps someone was trying to raise money by selling these pamphlets with the idea of buried treasure as a way of raising money for a local group, maybe a local Masonic group. But those two other codes have drawn a lot of attention. So this is paper two. And you can see it's a series of numbers. So 115, 73, 24, was it 807 going through. And that one was cracked. And what it was is it was used against the Declaration of Independence. So if you've seen the movie National Treasure, I think part of it was based in part on the Beale ciphers. So those numbers, if you go to the 115th word in the Declaration of Independence, which is instituted, and the first letter is I. And then you go to the 73rd letter, and the first letter is H. And you go to the 24th word, and the first letter is A. And so you get I-H-A-V-E, I have. And you can spell out the whole message. And it says, I have deposited in the county of Bedford, about 4 miles from Buford's, in an excavation or vault, 6 feet below the surface of the ground, the following articles belonging jointly to the parties whose names are given in number three herewith. The first deposit consisted of 1,014 pounds of gold and 3,812 pounds of silver, deposited November 1819. The second was made December 1821 and consisted of 1,907 pounds of gold and 1,288 pounds of silver. Also jewels obtained in St. Louis in exchange for silver to save transportation and valued at $13,000. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault is roughly lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone and are covered with others. Paper number one describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it. So many people, of course, have descended on Bedford, Virginia with shovels, and holes have been dug all around the town. No treasure has been found. It's sort of a precursor to modern geocaching. I don't know if anyone here is a geocacher. Though one of the rules of geocaching is you can't bury something, because once you bury it, it gets really, really difficult to find. But even having things that are not buried, sometimes things are still very, very difficult to find. So it's, you know, the paper number one, again, a series of numbers. This is the one supposedly with the locality. And paper number three, the names and residences, again, with a series of numbers. So kind of like, okay, so is it a real treasure, you know, or is it a hoax? You know, there's inconsistency. So someone was pointing out, if you read the story about how the gold was mined, and they said they were chased into this Box Canyon because there was a stampede. And someone was pointing out, stampede, that's kind of a new word in the language. Around the early 1800s, stampede wasn't a word that was used. So maybe that's a clue that this pamphlet was written years later as a kind of a hoax. Also, I mean, just kind of doing the sniff check on it. Okay, so you get three wagons full of gold that you transport all the way from southwestern United States to Virginia so you can bury it in Virginia. It's like, why are you transporting it that far? And also the third paper, we have encrypted the names of the owners. Why would you encrypt the names of the owners? Why would that information have to be secret? Jim Gologly, who was the head of the American Cryptogram Association, also did some interesting statistical analysis of the different codes. And he's got some interesting numbers to show that one of the papers was probably just random characters, or someone was just going through and was just bored and was just writing numbers. Because if you take that paper and you do apply it against the Declaration of Independence, you get kind of just garbage characters, but then you start getting the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, or A, B, 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 C, C, D, D, D. And it's the kind of thing that if someone were bored and they were just kind of picking random pairs of numbers, that's the kind of thing that someone might do as they were going through. Others say, no, that's not a proof of a debunking, that it's showing that, well, that there's maybe multi-layers. So you use the Declaration of Independence for the first layer, and then you use some other document for the next layer. But many people have worked on it pencil and paper. They've worked on it with computers, haven't come up with anything yet. So, and also, no other independent sources of information. All we have is that one pamphlet. So maybe a hoax, maybe an urban legend. We don't know. It's also possible that it's related to Freemasonry. And Freemasonry, one of the tenets of it is that continuing to ask questions is what you want to do. The search can be more important than what it is that you're trying to find. And there's a fable of, called The Farmer and His Sons, a farmer being at death's door and desiring to impart to his sons a secret of much moment, called them around him and said, "My sons, I am shortly about to die. I would have you know, therefore, that in my vineyard there lies a hidden treasure. Dig, and you will find it." As soon as their father was dead, the sons took spade and fork and turned up the soil of the vineyard over and over again in their search for the treasure which they supposed to be buried there. They found none, however, but the vines, after so thorough a digging, produced a crop such as had never before been seen. So the act, or the having the goal of looking for that hidden treasure, can keep you interested in tending a crop or searching the fields. So again, that search can be the valuable part rather than the actual treasure that you're looking for. All right. So was there a question? No, agreement. Okay. So cryptos. All right. This is the one that's I spent a lot of time on cryptos. So this is sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. It's about 12 feet tall, 20 feet long, four plates, sandborne design. Those plates, there's a pool at the bottom that's pushing the water in a circular pattern. We have the stones around it, petrified wood on the left. The letters are actually carved through the plates, so you can look through the plates and you're seeing like the trees and building on the other side. And he created this as a challenge to the employees at the CIA. It was, the CIA had outgrown its original headquarters building, and so they had commissioned a new headquarters building. And along with that building, they commissioned artwork to go around it. A committee was put together with the GSA, General Services Administration, the Art and Architecture Program, and they chose artists to create art. And Sanborn was someone who had already done large public art projects around Washington, D.C. He'd never done something with code. He'd never done something with text. But he had done things that related to invisible forces. He liked the concept of making things invisible visible. So, for example, in one of his art gallery installations, you might go into the room and you would see 100 strings hanging from the ceiling, all with needles hanging from each string, but they're all magnetized needles. So all the needles were all pointing at a lodestone that was at the far side of the room. And it was his way of showing that there were lines of force in that room that even though we couldn't see them, they were definitely affecting things in the room. He did things like this with tectonic forces, the Coriolis force. And this theme in his work of things invisible, making them visible, the members of the committee in the Art and Architecture Program, they liked this idea. They thought this kind of fit in with the CIA's mission of making things invisible visible. And so they hired him to create art for the around the building. And once he got the commission, he started doing more research about the CIA, and he decided he wanted to do a sculpture on the subject of encryption. And he was the director of the CIA at the time was William Webster. And Webster teamed Sanborn with Ed Scheidt. Ed Scheidt was the chairman of the CIA Cryptographic Center, who was in the process of retiring. So Scheidt got together with Sanborn for a few months and tutored him on cryptography. So again, Sanborn knew nothing about cryptography when he started this. And Scheidt taught him some basic systems. And then Sanborn went off into the southwest United States to get some materials. And on the drive back, he came up with the messages and he encrypted them. And I'll tell you what the first three parts say. I've talked to both Sanborn and Scheidt and to confirm that part four is solvable, and they have said, yes, it is solvable. I'll go into more exactly what they've said about it. These are a couple of the rubbings that I did when I got a chance to see CIA, when I got invited there to speak about Al-Qaeda codes. Each one of these is done on an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper to kind of give you a sense of the scale of the letters and of the sculpture. So the first person to solve it publicly was Jim Galogli, who in 1999, a computer scientist, he ran a computer attack on it. After he came forward, the CIA said, well, we have someone named David Stein, and he solved it in 1998. And then the NSA came forward and said, well, we have people that solved it too, but we're not going to tell you who and we're not going to tell you when, which is very NSA, the no such agency thing to say. But I've dug up more information about this, and I'll tell you about that. And what happened was that in 1992, the CIA's deputy director, William Studeman, who had been a director at the NSA, Now that he was at CIA, went back to NSA and said, okay, you guys think you're so hot at cracking codes, come crack cryptos. And they, NSA took up the challenge, and they put together a team, and they ran computer attacks with the NSA computers. Could not solve all four parts. They solved the first three parts in 1992, and they sent a memo to CIA, but they hadn't been able to solve part four. And I've talked to members of that team, and they're kind of frustrated by it. they still can continue to kind of work with it. The main reason that part four hasn't been solved is mainly it's very short. It's only 97 characters. And any cryptographer who's working with codes likes to have lots of ciphertext to work with, because then you can kind of munch it and look for those mathematical patterns. But with 97 characters, it gets really tough. If this thing happened in the field, they'd probably like stamp it as needs more collection. We need more codes to be sent of this type of system so that we can kind of number crunch it. And that was how in World War II, for example, the Enigma ciphers were often cracked, because we had a lot of data to work with. And we looked at patterns of what messages were being sent with Enigma, where they were being sent from. For example, and the Germans encrypted everything. So, for example, there might be a message that was sent every morning, same time, from a weather station. Encrypted. Well, chances are pretty good it has something to do with the weather. Okay. So, and you could kind of, okay, it's clear today, it's rainy today. So the chances that those words, raining, clear, cloudy, poor visibility, whatever, are going to be in that encrypted message, that increases the likelihood that that message is going to be cracked. It's a crib that you can use to try and get things out of it. And we had other ways to crack Enigma. There would people who would make mistakes. So they were supposed to change the code every day, but if they didn't change the code and they kept using the same code system, that would be a crib as well. Or someone was supposed to be using a word that was a random word, but they might use a word that was associated with their boyfriend's name or their dog or whatever. Each one of those things would make things easier for code crackers to take the thing apart. Sorry? They would start off with some sort of salutation. Yeah, these are definitely cribs that could be used. And any time a message has something that repeats every time, it makes it easier to crack. Okay. So that NSA effort, and this is something new that I didn't talk about. So this is new stuff for it. How many people have been to my talk before? I'm just curious. Okay, so new stuff. That NSA effort, when they sent a memo to the CIA, I wanted to see that memo, and they wouldn't show it to me because they said it was classified. And I disagreed with the fact that efforts to solve a recreational cipher should be classified. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request on that memo in 2010. And I filed it in March 2010, and I said I wanted all information related to the NSA team that was formed to solve the puzzles of the crypto sculpture. And I got a nice letter back in April saying, we'll do this. There will be fees for search. Are you willing to pay them? I wrote back and I said yes. In June, they wrote back and said, okay, we've completed our search. We found the materials. You are in the first in, first out processing queue. This is June 2010. And for non-personal, easy cases, but since there were several cases ahead of mine, they might not be able to respond within 20 days. So I waited 6 months and then I wrote back. And they said, well, the reference case is actively being worked and, in fact, has already made it through the first level of review. There are additional review and approval stages, and there are other cases ahead of yours, so it may be some time before you receive the response. So I waited another 6 months, and then I wrote. And they said, oh, you're in the final approval stages. You know, I wait another 6 months. I write again. Your FOIA case is in the final approval stage. So this was going on for years, and I had people in the government telling me, you're never going to get it. This is just their way of stringing you along. But summer of this year, I got a big, thick envelope in the mail. It was approved. So this is, and let me see if I can get it better. I think that's as dark as it's going to get on this one. It's down at the bottom here. It says secret, and it's crossed out. And this says it's approved for release by NSA on May 21st, 2013, FOIA case number 61191. That's me. Thank you very much. So I scanned this all into a big PDF, and I post online, and it made international news. So if some of you are thinking, oh, I saw something about cryptos in the news, it's probably related to this FOIA. You can go to my website, ilanka.com/cryptos/FOIA.html. And I also bring it up as it is possible to get documents from the government and not have to go to Ecuador right after that, okay? there are legal ways to do it. Okay, so a little more so also kind of going more into the FOIA, what did I find? What they told me, that they'd solved the first three parts, they hadn't solved the fourth part, and it was interesting kind of seeing the techniques that they'd used for it. They investigated the keywords that were used in it. So I didn't really see anything new in it, but I was very glad to finally, you know, have the document. So other things that I found while I was doing my research on Cryptos is I found that after Sanborn made Cryptos, he created another piece, which he called the Untitled Cryptos piece, which he sold to a private collector. And I tracked this down. It's in the home of one of the dot-com millionaires in California. And this thing has all the text of Cryptos on one side. And on the other side, it has all the text of Cryptos on one side. And on the other side, it has encrypted Russian text. This is all in the Cyrillic language. And we've cracked the code on the Cyrillic side, and it came out to be extracts of classified KGB documents. And so then there's a whole other story of how did Sanborn get a hold of classified KGB documents. And so Sanborn, he made another version of this, which is about 20% larger. And this one you can actually see at the Hirshhorn Museum. So if you go to D.C. and it's that big oval museum that's on the mall. And so this is the piece that's in the home of the dot-com millionaire. And this is the piece that's at the Hirshhorn Museum. And it's got all the same text. This one's just about 20% larger. So here you can see kind of the Latin text, and here you can see the Cyrillic text. And the Cyrillic text is reproduced on another of Sanborn's sculptures, which is called the Cyrillic Projector. This has about the first 75% of what's on the Untitled Cryptos piece. And this is currently in University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Anyone who's been there, it's between the Friday and the Fretwell buildings. And this cylinder is about 12 feet tall. It's got a light on the inside of it that beams this encrypted text all around the courtyard. And Sanborn used this for his gallery installations, and he liked the idea of people walking through the room and having this encrypted text kind of cover the visitors as they would walk through the room. He liked the idea of them being tainted by the codes. So anyone who knows Cyrillic and knows letters, one thing you're going to notice as you walk through there is you're going to see a few letters over here that are not Cyrillic. There's no S in the Cyrillic alphabet. There's no U. Does not appear like that. And that's actually the last part of a longer word that says Medusa. And Medusa is actually one of the keywords for cracking the cipher that's on the Cyrillic projector. So it was his way of presenting a clue on how to solve this code. Another interesting thing about Antipodes is on the English side, it's the same text as on Cryptos, but with two differences. One difference is that the sections are in a different order than they are on Cryptos. Instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, it's like 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, and then it kind of chops out. And there's also some dots. So on the Untitled piece, right about here, there's these two dots. The letters are the same as what's on Cryptos, but the dots appear only on the Untitled piece in Antipodes, the one at the Hirshhorn, and not on Cryptos. Why the dots are there, we have guesses, but we're not certain. Okay, so let me go more into what crypto says. So here's the sculpture. There's the four sections of code are on one side, and then we have a visioneer's table on the other side, which is a polyalphabetic cryptographic system. And one way to do it is first you want to make a cipher alphabet. And one way to make a cipher alphabet is you take a keyword. In this case, the keyword is cryptos. And so you take all the letters of cryptos out of the alphabet, and you push them all to the left of the alphabet. So you end up with a string that's still 26 letters long, but it's now scrambled via a method that's very easy to reproduce in the field, especially some sort of battlefield where there's a lot going on. If you can just remember the key, you can make that string. Right. Then, say we've got this 26-letter string, and then you shift everything by one. So we're shifting it to the left, so this one starts with an R, and then this one starts with a Y, and then down here. And a neat artifact of this is that you can read the word cryptos here, but if you also read down the left-hand column, you can also read the word cryptos. So now we're going to make it a little bit harder, and there's many different methods of visionaire system. Let's say we're going to have a different word that's spelled down the left column. In this case, we're going to have the word palimpsest. Palimpsest is a word meaning a scroll that's had one message written on it, and then that message was scraped off, and another message was written on the scroll, such that you can still see parts of the original message showing through. It could also be done with, say, a metallic plaque, where there's something written on one side of the plaque, and on the other side you can put something, you can see bits of the message showing through. You could also use it, say, to refer to a city. People could say that the city of Rome is a palimpsest, because you can be standing on a street corner, you're seeing modern buildings around you. You also have the Roman Colosseum, a medieval cathedral, so you're seeing bits of the old history of Rome showing through on a modern city street. Right. So with those keys of Kryptos and Palimpsest, we're going to solve part one, which is these top two rows on the sculpture. So here we have our grid where we still have the Kryptos cipher alphabet, but we're spelling the word Palimpsest down the left-hand column. So the ciphertext, going back here, so E-M-U-F-P-H-Z, those are the first letters. So we take E-M-U-F-P-H, we put each one on a different line. The E, we're going to trace up to here, becomes a B. M becomes an E, U becomes a T, F becomes a W, P becomes an E. So E-M-U-F-P-H-Z becomes B-E-T-W-E-E-N, between. And if you keep extending this grid all the way down and keep putting letter after letter, and there's mathematical ways of doing it, but this is one way of representing it, you can come up with what we call the ciphertext here using a polyalphabetic substitution system, and the keywords of Kryptos and Palimpsest comes out to the plain text of between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Now, there's this Q there, and I've asked Sanborn about that. I said, was that a mistake, a typo? He said, no, but it's not. It was deliberate, but it's not what it is that's so important. It's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. Don't know what that means either.
Does that occur in other places as well?
There are other, yes, does it occur?
That's another cipher within a cipher within.
It's possible. It's possible, absolutely. Part two starts here on the third row, goes down to the bottom of this plate. This is the ciphertext. Sanborn did admit that there was an error here. He'd left a letter out of the bottom. That was announced a few years ago. And the plain text uses the same method as part one, but instead of Kryptos and Palimpsest, the keys are Kryptos and abscissa. Abscissa is a mathematical term meaning the x-coordinate on a graph. It was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by rows. Or we thought the bottom part said ID by rows until he announced the error, and what it actually says is X, layer 2. Not that that's a whole lot more understandable. Part 3 starts at the top of this plate, goes all the way down to here. Also notice there's a few letters here that are sort of out of alignment. And Sanborn has said that this is important, but he hasn't said what's important about it. Part 3. This is ciphertext. Anyone who's played with codes can probably look at this and see that the letter distribution is a bit different from 1 and 2. It's got more vowels in it, E's and A's and T's. So this is a different system. It's not a substitution system. It's a transposition system. This is a method I came up with for solving it. If you put part 3 in and start at the middle of the last column, go S and then count down 4 to L, count down another 4 to O, count down another 4 to W, S, L, O, W. Slowly, desperately. So the plain text of part 3 is slowly, desperately, slowly. The remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner, and then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. Anyone recognize that? It's a paraphrased extract from the diary of an archaeologist named Howard Carter, November 26, 1922. He was discovering King Tut's tomb, and Sanborn liked this passage because he felt that uncovering a tomb was sort of like cracking a code. You're kind of brushing away debris and bringing something up from underneath. And then there's part four, 97 characters, can't tell you what it says, we don't know. Part four on the sculpture would be start about there and would be about these bottom four lines of the sculpture. Now, the latitude and longitude, 3857, 6.5 north, points to the general location of CIA. This is the original headquarters building. This is the new headquarters building, which is when they commissioned the art. This building with the funny-shaped roof in the middle, this is the cafeteria. Sanborn designed this courtyard here, and he also designed some artwork here around the front entrance to the new headquarters building. And Kryptos is right here in the upper left-hand corner. So as the CIA employees are sitting in the cafeteria looking out the window to the courtyard, they can see Kryptos there. This is another image. So again, we have the cafeteria. Here's some cars and trucks here for scale. And Sanborn designed this entire area. So Kryptos is about there. Now the coordinates, some people were thinking that it points directly to Kryptos. No, it points to right about here, about 150 feet southeast of Kryptos. We've gone there, we've looked, we haven't found anything. There's manhole covers like all over the place. It's possible there's something underground. He also designed some pieces over here. There's a duck pond here with some stone slabs that are kind of pointing at Kryptos. Here's another image. You can sort of see the pond and the slabs, and then the slabs here. So we have sort of parallel lines with the diagonals. And these slabs, they're these huge concrete slabs that are like tilted out of the ground, sort of like a geological seam coming into view, something underground coming into view. And then there's these Morse code messages that say things like SOS, shadow forces, lucid memory, T is your position. And then there's a lodestone here, a magnetic lodestone, which is, and there's a carved compass rose, but the compass rose is not pointing to real north, it's pointing to that lodestone as though it's north. He's also made two other pieces around the Washington, D.C. area that also have these carved compass roses. We've tried like going to a big map to see where all the compasses point, but they haven't found anything there. So we think it's just a reference to the early theme of magnetism in his work. The Morse code that says T is your position, I asked him if that's actually supposed to say what is your position, and we just can't see the full line because it disappears under the slab, and he said yes. So we know there's Morse code messages that we can't read. And I said, well, how are we supposed to read them? He just kind of shrugged. Sorry? We're not?
What? You're not supposed to read them.
I mean, he did say that when he installed these pieces at CIA, that each day they would come out with powerful neutron scanners and scan everything that he'd done because they wanted to make sure he wasn't planting a bug or doing something on CIA grounds. So it's possible that when they were doing these scans, if they could scan through stone, there might be like an X-ray image, you know, of the Morse code's metallic messages. I've been trying to locate any copies of those scans. They haven't had any luck. My guess is that they've been destroyed since then. What? Well, you can do a FOIA request, but only if you have an idea of what you're requesting, and they have to be able to find it. It's not a case of them saying it's there and you can't see it. So we've done FOIA requests where they just say, we've looked, we can't find it. And do another Kryptos? If someone has $200,000, I'm sure he would be happy to do another Kryptos. When the Kryptos was dedicated in late 1990 at the dedication ceremony, Sanborn handed an envelope with the solution to William Webster. Evidently, he wrote and he was debating on how to present the solution in such a way that it didn't just give it away. So my understanding is that he had it written on a piece of paper and then he tore the paper into sections, put all those sections in the envelope, and then handed the envelope to Webster. We've been trying to find that envelope. We filed FOIA requests on the envelope. They can't find it. I have located the director of public affairs, who was the person that Webster handed the envelope to right after the dedication ceremony. But the director of public affairs isn't talking. But I'm going to continue asking and see if he knows where that is. But it was like 20 years ago. If someone handed you an envelope 20 years ago and someone asked you today, where's the envelope? You know, who knows? There was a question here.
Shadow forces, is it possible that shadow forces could refer to the illumination of certain points of the statue at a certain time of the year? Does that mean anything?
Very possible. Sanborn loves playing with light and shadow. And as we saw with the Cyrillic projector and with other pieces of his work, it's possible. But even knowing that, we'd still need to know, do we need to stand you know, do we need to stand at the latitude and longitude? So we've been doing some things with creating 3D models of the crypto sculpture so we can see the way the sun moves at different times of year to see if we can see anything with the shadows or things pointing. Haven't come up with anything, but it's definitely one of the things that we're looking at. But just because we're looking at it doesn't mean we're looking at it the right way. So if someone here has an idea, go for it. Like, I could give you some ciphertext and I could say it's encrypted with Visionaire. And that could mean 25 different things. Is it encrypted with a cipher alphabet? Is it encrypted with a plain text alphabet? Is it double encrypted? Is it triple encrypted? Do you start with the plain text alphabet over here or on the column? And so just because we've tried something doesn't mean we've tried the exact correct method of doing it. And I'm just talking fast here because I know we're running out of time. This is again, kind of showing where everything is in relation. So the coordinates are here. It's possible that the coordinates, you know, with this diagonal and diagonal, that the coordinates are actually referring to something not in the courtyard, but to something out here. And there is this interesting little block. It has no Morse code. It's not part of the other seam. It seems to be sort of in an arrowhead form. And we've had people go out and look at it, and they can't really see anything else about it. It may or may not be related. We don't know. Other things we've noticed is on the Visionaire side, where you have these ending letters, they should be in the same order of the cipher alphabet. So EFGHIJL, EFGHILL. So there's an extra L on this line. And that line is the same line as the other side where the letters are out of alignment. So it's possible that Sanborn is trying to draw people's eyes to that line for some reason. With the Cyrillic projector, and here's that Medusa. Now, where does the word Medusa come from on the projector? Is John Wilson in the room? There was a DragonCon attendee who actually made a discovery on this. He went to Charlotte and took a look at it. The word Medusa comes from the third row on this plate. And on that row, there's an extra bolt. And it's difficult to see here, but if you look from the other side, there is a clear extra bolt on that line. So it's possible that Sanborn did that to draw people's eyes to this line, saying that there's something there, there's something important. So it's possible that one reason that Kryptos hasn't been solved is because we can't get into CIA to really take a close look at it. I got in, but I've only been in once, and I was only able to look at it for a couple hours. I've tried many times to get back in to say, hey, you know, this is the 20th anniversary of Kryptos. I give a great talk on Kryptos. Can I come in? And silence. I get nothing. So this is Ed Scheidt. And I've spent a lot of time talking to him as well. I'm actually organizing a dinner in Washington, D.C. with Sanborn and Scheidt. Anyone who's in D.C. this fall that wants to come to the dinner, let me know. I'll give you information on it. He said that we solved the first three parts using the patterns of the English language, but that he removed that advantage for part four. He said he used a little bit of stego in part four. But he's also said the last part is in English and it is solvable. So he's implied he knows what it says, but then when I ask him if he knows what it says, he says that he's not going to answer. So he gets very CIA, very spook on me about it. But he did say we solved the first three parts without recovering the keys first, whatever that means. And he also said it does use all the letters and it's in English. Now, Sanborn did give a hint. He said in part four, from the 64th position, NYP VTT, he said that the plain text there is the word Berlin. And this was a flurry of activity as we were trying to, okay, we have a crib. We know part of the plain text. Can we solve the rest of it? Haven't solved the rest of it. We did look using Visionaire systems to see if we could find some key pairs that might produce the word Berlin in that position, and we did. We found if we use the same Visionaire method, but with instead of abscissa and cryptos, shifted and binary, that we could get the word Berlin to show up right there. Nothing else readable before it, nothing readable after it. But then we did more searching, and we found out that we can do a lot of key pairs to get the word Berlin, like overcrowds Bulgarian will also produce the word Berlin right there, or drifts mobilize. So shifted binary sort of sounded like it was in the cryptos family. It sounded intriguing, but it's probably a dead end, but again, we're not sure. And we've done a lot of other searching. I told you about the alignment. He said that was important. Another interesting thing he said is this was the most common image of Kryptos, but Sanborn said he didn't like this image. He said that's the ugly side. He said this is the front of Kryptos. This is the side of Kryptos. And he was so adamant about that I'm working to change the images to say, okay, this is the front and that's the side. But it, to my eye, it's such a subtle difference. But maybe this has something to do with the axes there. Don't know. So Berlin, it's also possible it has something to do with the Berlin Wall, which was falling at right about the time that Sanborn was creating Kryptos. There is a Berlin Wall monument at CIA, and they hadn't chosen a location for it at the time that Kryptos was being created, but perhaps the latitude and longitude were intended to be where he thought it was going to be. Again, just speculation. The actual Berlin Wall monument. So the coordinates point here, and then the monument is actually installed right about there on the CIA site. Real quick about the Da Vinci Code. If you look at the back part of the book jacket in this area that looks like a tear, very faintly you can see the words "only WW knows." This is a reference to part two of Kryptos. And also on the back near the blurbs, very faintly, light red on dark red, we have coordinates here. I don't know if you can see them, but it has the latitude and longitude coordinates, again, from part two of Kryptos. And these were referring to the next novel, Lost Symbol. So why hasn't K4 been solved yet? Well, it's short. It's only 97 characters. It's possible there's a key on CIA grounds. Remember, Kryptos was never designed as a public challenge. It was designed as a challenge to the employees at the CIA. So it's possible we just don't have access to something. We may have missed something. We may have been misdirected. It's also possible he just messed it up, and it's not solvable. But there's been so much attention on it now. And he did come forward to say that there was a mistake he'd found. But he's adamant that it's done right. And when I've gone out to dinner with Ed Scheidt and bought him drinks and tried to get him talking, I really went at him one day saying, well, I'm a game designer. People mess up games all the time. They mess up puzzles all the time. Maybe Sanborn made a mistake. Maybe it's not solvable. And Scheidt was, I'm sure it's done right. So, again, he implies that he knows what the answer is without specifically saying that he knows what the answer is. Both Sanborn and Scheidt have said that it's solvable. My own goal is not necessarily be the person that solves Kryptos. I would like to see it solved. I would like it off my plate. And so if I can help see it solved by presenting information about it, I'm more than happy to do that. So I have a lot of information on my website, elonka.com/kryptos. There's a great documentary that I worked with PBS, the Nova Science Now show, to make. You can get, and anyone who wants to is welcome to join our discussion group. We have a Yahoo group, kryptos-subscribe@yahoogroups.com, and you'll join that group. Some other articles I wrote in Secrets of the Lost Symbol. So have I covered everything? Are there any questions? Sure. Microphone. Yes.
Not such a question, more or less a comment, like what was stated earlier with the deliberate placement of certain letters, the eye attention to the extra bolt, the extra F, the dots, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. Goes back to what I said, there could be clues within the already solved, codes that could lead to solving the rest of it.
Right.
Because of like the Berlin thing, mm-hmm. The various words used as cribs, mm-hmm. nothing worked.
Mm-hmm.
So I just a thought.
Yeah, I mean, we encourage all ideas in the discussion group because we've had the hardcore cryptographers who've been working on this code for decades now, and we haven't solved it. So it's very possible that the final solution is going to be from someone at a Dragon Con talk or someone, a child, anyone who's just going to have an idea out of left field. Okay, like Mercury Rising. And I've had codes that were solved because I'd be working on something, and I've had like a five-year-old looking at this code, and they said, oh, it's like a staircase. And I look at them like, what? And they go, it's like a staircase. And I used a stair-step pattern. The code cracked. I have no idea how that five-year-old came up with staircase, but they were right. So I'll talk to everyone. And it may be a mashup, and you see here at Dragon Con mashups between costumes and different styles and genres, or maybe it'll be someone who's a gardener pilot who's going to come up with some idea or some way of looking at Kryptos that's finally going to open the thing up. We don't know. Any other questions? Yes. I'm sorry.
The earliest claimant was like 2 years, right?
The earliest claim?
The claim of having solved at least the first part of it.
Kryptos was installed in 1990. Gologli solved it in 1999. They said Stein had solved his parts in 98, and the NSA had done had put their team together in 1992.
Now, part four, I understand he's got a website up there that you've got a that you speculated says this. You can actually send those pages to him, and he'll tell you right off the bat whether you're right or wrong.
Right, there's a he has a website, I think it's called cryptosclue.com, where if someone has solved it, they can they need to give him the first 10 letters of the solution and put it in his website. And to those of you that are geeks that are thinking, "Oh, well I'll just send every possible combination of 10 letters. It's been tried. It pissed him off. Don't do it again."
But anyway, the first part, it only had one of the two key words was right on the darn
yes, on the Cyrillic projector. Right.
It still took them that long
right.
to crack it, even though they had the alpha bet on the side.
Yeah. And, well, it was one keyword. They still needed a second keyword. In the Cyrillic projector, the keywords in Russian were Medusa and Tien. Tien being the Russian word for either light or dark. I don't know if anyone speaks Russian in here. And on Kryptos with abscissa and palimpsest, those are the keys, but they don't appear anywhere that we know of that's on the sculpture. We came up with them kind of reverse engineering. We knew what the plain text was, then we look back to see what the key must have been to derive that plain text. Scheidt has implied that those keys, abscissa and palimpsest, are derivable somewhere around the sculpture. But maybe we're not understanding his clue. Maybe he means deriving it by using the patterns of English. We don't know. We don't know. Any other questions? So I guess if I want everyone to have a takeaway here, one is be persistent. There were so many times in my own journey where people were saying, you can't do it. The FBI said no. You know, the FOIA request going on for years. But being persistent often pays off. And if you talk to really successful people like Will Wright, who did SimCity and The Sims, when he was asked what is the secret of success, his answer was pathological persistence. Just don't give up. Just keep going at it. And also, if you don't find the specific thing that you're looking for, sometimes you may find other interesting things along the way. My own crypto journey has brought me into giving talks at Dragon Con, and I have a book out, and I've gotten a certain amount of internet fame. I've had like 4 million hits on my Ilanka.com website just because I'm interested in different topics. And every so often you find something that other people are interested in too. And the journey, it's just interesting where the journey can take you. So don't turn away from something that looks like a dead end. If it interests you, go ahead and explore it. And thank you for coming.